100 years ago this past week, the 14th of March, 1879, Albert Einstein was born in the little South German town of Ulm. His family had lived in this area of southern Germany since the middle of the 18th century. There was, as far as we know, no intermarriage in the family. Yet it was one clearly which was indifferent to any substantial meaning involved in its religious inheritance, the label Jew. There was a synagogue in this little townlet, but Einstein's parents did not attend. As far as we know, he was never enrolled for a single hour in classes in a religious school. The home served shellfish and pork as freely as the family ate it in restaurants on the outside. Albert Einstein's father was an electrical contractor. Unfortunately, his scientific ability was not matched with equal business competence. I don't know if he knew, and I'm sure he did not know, the old Hebrew proverb, Meshaneh Makom, Meshaneh Mazel, that if you change the place there you live, the place where you work, you'll change your luck. But it was obviously a bit of folk wisdom which was instinctive to him. The family was a rolling stone family. Every few years, another business went bad, and they would pick up stakes and try the father's luck in another town. And so when Einstein was about ready to enter into what we would call elementary school, the family moved to Munich. There was, as you would imagine, a fine Jewish school in Munich. Einstein was enrolled in a Catholic school, which was closer to home and therefore more convenient. During the years that he was in the gymnasium and later the years in which he was in the Polytechnical Institute in Switzerland, his life was one in which no attempt was made to involve himself in Jewish causes and issues of Jewish identity, or even socially with Jews. It seems to have been a matter of relative indifference to him and to his family. His first marriage was to a lapsed Catholic. The marriage was an unfortunate one and an unhappy one, and ended in divorce. But the issue of religion seems not to have been one of the causative issues of the divorce. It seems, in fact, never to have arisen within the family group. By the time Einstein was 30, he had, of course, achieved world fame. One of the unique facts about scientific genius, theoretical scientific genius, seems to be that the great breakthroughs are made when a man is still fairly young, and when a person is in their late teens or early 20s. Einstein, by the time he was 30, had published the special theory of relativity. He had published important work in the theory of light. His name had become known in the scientific world. And I suspect if you had asked Einstein at the age of 30 whether he had put any amount of thought or involvement in the fact that he was a Jew, he would have been surprised at the question and said no. He not even thought of his Jewishness, it would seem, in terms of disadvantages which accrued to being Jewish in Germany, Europe, the early part of the century. Einstein had gone to the Luitpold Gymnasium in Munich, and he'd been sent down without a diploma. When he had graduated with his doctoral degree from the Polytechnical Institute in Switzerland, he did not receive an academic appointment. It was for this reason that he had to hire himself to the Swiss Patent Office, examining the models of inventions submitted to that office by Swiss engineers to see whether or not they qualified for a certificate of patent. Many men, given the realities of anti-Semitism in Europe at that period of time, would have seen these acts as anti-Semitic. directed against themselves because they were Jew. Einstein did not. He was a man who was remarkably frank with himself, and he knew that he had been a difficult youth, a rebel, independent, a student who had paid little attention to classes or teachers who did not interest him, who made no attempt to get assignments in on time or even in if he felt that they were unworthy or unnecessary, or silly. At the university, he had insisted on calling his professors Mr. So-and-so instead of Herr Professor, since by their first name rather than with any kind of honorific title. And he had over the years built up a good bit of personal anger directed against the rebel. We forget that the young Einstein was as much a bohemian, as typical of the youth that we saw in the late 1960s as anybody could be, given relative poverty and the conservatism of southern Germany and Switzerland at the time. And Einstein knew that the piper had to be paid. That if you were going to step on the sensibilities of your professors, if you weren't going to do your work because you considered it demeaning or silly, one of these men was going to see to it that you didn't get the diploma or the job or the opportunity that you sought after. And so it came to be. But the issue was not his Jewishness. The issue was his person. And that he knew. He thought he knew. At 30 then, Einstein emerges as a wunderkind, a genius, a man whose fame is already beginning to be worldwide, a great theoretical physicist who happens to be a Jew. By the time he is 40, Einstein is not only the world-renowned physicist who happens to be a Jew, but a Jew who is actively involved in matters Jewish. A Jew who is recognized by his fellow Jews not only as one of our contributions to civilization, but as a man who is making great contributions to Jewish life itself. This man who up to the age of 30 had paid no attention to Jewishness, had not involved himself in Jewish life at all, suddenly by the time he is 40 is planning to leave his library and his study at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin to accompany Chaim Weizmann to the United States on that ultimate of all Jewish undertakings, a fundraising mission to raise funds for the Keren HaYesod and for the contemplated Hebrew University in Jerusalem. When he was 30, Einstein would not have known the difference between the Besht, Israel Baal Shem Tov, and Elijah the Gaon of Vilna. I found in my father's files, along with a lot of other correspondence, a number of letters that Einstein had written him in his late 40s, dealing with a man by the name of Benjamin Lewin. Benjamin Lewin was a Russian Jew, a scholar, who had emigrated in the Second Aliyah to Palestine and who had become in Palestine the leading authority on Geonic literature. Geonic literature is a rather esoteric form of Jewish legal literature, halachic responsa from the 8th and 9th century, originating in the academies of Sura and Pumbedita in Babylon. If you find those few details to be somewhat strange to you, imagine how they would have appeared to Einstein when he was 28 or 29 or 30. But here is Einstein speaking of some days spent with Benjamin Lewin, speaking of the importance of his research and publication, asking for if some help can be given to the man and to his publications, and to a vision that he shares with this man, with this Jewish scholar, that a great institute for the publication, for the research and publication of halachic Jewish studies be established in these United States. Now, that's a great change. What made for the change? How did the physicist become a Jew? In all of the photographic essays, the television essays, the writings that have appeared these last weeks in honor of the centennial of Einstein's birth, little attention has been made to that side of the genius, and I'd like to try for a moment today to deal with it with you, because obviously Einstein lived through many of the things that many of us lived through. He was part of our century, the pressures, came in upon him, and his response to them is not of any lack of interest to us. The first thing which we must do in order to understand Einstein the Jew is to disabuse ourselves of the legendary Einstein. The Einstein who comes down to us as a gentle teddy bear kind of professor, a great avuncular figure who bounces the neighbor's children on his knees, who's always ready to do their mathematics homework and sometimes gets it wrong. The Einstein who is somehow very human, very open, very warm, very avuncular. That simply was not Alfred Einstein. Einstein was a tough-minded, self-centered, wholly analytic human being. He was a mind that happened to be tied to a body. Minds have to be. But he was essentially an intellect. He had very little instinctive compassion. He had very little need for friendship. He had almost no capacity to sustain a long, intimate relationship. We think of Einstein talking with the neighbor's children as he walked to and from his office in Princeton in his old age. Towards his children, he was coolly distant. He provided for them, but little more. Towards his first wife, he became terribly angry because she insisted on intimacy, on sharing his world. She was a physicist. She wanted to know what he was doing, and he had no intentions of telling her. He tolerated his second wife and remained with her for the rest of his life because she was a wonderful maid. She served him, she catered to him, she protected him, she saw that he had food on the table and clean linen when he needed it. She never intruded his life. Einstein is a man who lived within a shell, a set of preoccupations. In 1911, Einstein took a position at the German University in Prague. At that time, there was in Prague a small group of Jewish intellectuals who used to meet at the salon of a woman named Bertha Fant. She was a very intelligent, vivacious woman, and Einstein became interested in her world and attracted to people like Franz Kafka, Max Brod, who came regularly to her chambers. Einstein met there this young novelist, Max Brod. And the very next novel that Max Brod wrote was a novel about the life of Tycho Brahe. Brahe was a 16th century Czech astrophysicist, the father of modern astronomy, and the teacher of Kepler. Revived all of our understanding of the nature of the universe, stars, the solar system. He pictured young Kepler as the young Einstein that he knew. And that's interesting. He says he did. After all, Kepler made his great discoveries when he was a young man. He too was a scientific genius. He too was a theoretical physicist. What was more natural than to describe Kepler out of Einstein? Now listen to Max Brod on Kepler-Einstein. The tranquility with which he applied himself to his labors and entirely ignored the warblings of flatterers was almost superhuman. There was something incomprehensible in its absence of emotion, like a breath from a distant region of ice. He had no heart, and therefore had nothing to fear from the world. He was not capable of emotion or love. For that reason, he was also secure against the aberrations of feeling. He had no heart, therefore had nothing to fear from the world. He was not capable of emotion or love. For that reason, he was also secure against the aberrations of feeling. Now, Brod liked Einstein. And Einstein knew a good bit of this about himself. Here is Einstein on Einstein. My passionate interest in social justice and social responsibility has always stood in curious contrast to a marked lack of desire for direct association with men and women. I am a horse for single harness, not cut out for tandem or teamwork. I have never belonged wholeheartedly to country or state, to my circle of friends, or even to my own family. These ties have always been accompanied by a vague aloofness, and the wish to withdraw into myself increases with the years. I have never belonged wholeheartedly to anyone. The desire for aloofness, for withdrawal, has only increased with the years. Einstein came to his involvement with Jews, the Jewish people, intellectually. Not empathetically, not as a matter of some chance meeting, not out of sympathy for some Jewish suffering, but as a cold bit of calculation based on his principles, his convictions, what he saw, what he thought he saw, what he knew, and what he thought he knew. As a young man, as a young rebel, Einstein came to certain convictions quite early. And they're very interesting. Imagine that at the age of 15, Einstein renounced his German citizenship. He felt that his professors, teachers at the gymnasium were typical of Germany, rigorous, arbitrary, disciplined, iron will, unfeeling, romantically and militaristically and imperialistically chauvinist. He didn't want any part of that kind of Germany. He did not believe in nation states. He believed in world order. He felt that most of the boundaries of nations were artificial. And all his life, from the age of 15 or 16 on, he was committed to internationalism, to an end to the what he would call the stupid divisions between countries. He lived in the international world of science, and he believed that sense of internationalism must exist between men and women at all levels in all areas of life. At 15 or 16, he was angered by the divisions between wealth and poverty, by the inherited wealth of the German princes and Prussian Junkers. He came to the conviction that the natural resources of the state should be owned by the citizenry. He came to socialism, as well as internationals. And he saw that the divisions of between the possessions of men, the divisions between the states inevitably led to war. And war was simply and clearly evil, bloody, purposeless. He became a pacifist. Internationalism, socialism, pacifism were clear principles of his life as basic to the nature, natural order of things as E equals MC squared. Though later on, under the pressure of Hitler and Nazism, he moderated a bit his pacifism. At some point, evil, he came to understand, needed to be defended against. These basic principles arrived at by the young man, the young Einstein, analytically, remains principles of him, his throughout his life. His Zionism, his re-involvement with the Jewish people, was based on his reactions to these principles. For him, Zionism, as he came to understand it, was the movement for the human liberation of Jews. He saw that Jews were being treated as a people apart. He saw that with the rise of European nationalism, which ended in the First World War, divisions between nation states, which were unconscionable in his mind, were also destructive to any opportunity for the Jew to emerge as a true citizen of the world. So Israel, Palestine, didn't know the name Israel, obviously, the Holy Land, the Herzl vision, became for him the vision of a cultural center in which there would be no limitations on the ability of the Jew to emerge as a mind, as a man, as a contributing element of civilization. His first exposure to Zionism came in the Salon in Prague in 1911. Bertha Fandt was a Zionist. She was a disciple of Herzl. It's well to remember that Herzl's vision of the Jewish state was a vision of an almost secular social democracy, in which, under a governmental form much like that of the Scandinavian countries, the Jews would have one advantage that they had not in Europe. That is, they would be at home, there would be no quotas, there would be no discrimination, there could be the natural evolution of the spirit of the individual Jew. He heard of these ideas in the salon of Bertha Funk, and then when he moved back to Zurich and then finally to Berlin in 1914, he took these ideas with him and he applied them against the facts of the First World War. It's hard to remember that the First World War was so radically different than the Second. The First World War came upon a Europe which still, in many cases, thought of itself as a unit, as a great cultural unit whose values would ultimately be taken over and made part of the life of the rest of the world. The concept of a nation state had grown really only in the 19th century. It was still a new idea, divisive idea to many. First World War saw countries fight other countries where brothers were on two sides of the border, where the kings of or ruling princes of one house had originally originated in the land of the enemy. It was the war which tore Europe apart, for it was a war essentially between a Germany and a France and an England who at that time seemed to espouse the same Western humanitarian political values. Einstein accepted the position as director of the physics section of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in 1914, just before the war began. He'd hardly settled into place when the war broke out. The German troops began to march into the lowlands. 93 of the leading scientists of Germany at that time immediately signed a manifesto in which they said, among other things, were it not for German militarism, German culture would have been wiped off the face of the earth. It was an apologia for the march of the German armies. And the men who signed this manifesto were the leading scientists of Germany, Frank and Röntgen, Ehrlich, men whose names were world famous. Suddenly, Einstein saw that there were men, scientists, who he thought were part of an international fraternity, who in fact were more German than scientists, who were willing to put their resources, their skills to work for the sake of the German military machine to develop poison gas or develop some other weapon of the war. Einstein was one of only four scientists in all of Germany who at the time were willing to sign a counter-manifesto which said in essence, the case is not Germany but Europe. It is the duty of scientists to prevent Europe from succumbing to death by fratricide. All his principles cried out against what was happening in Europe. But he began to realize that nationalism was part of the European world order. And he saw the consequences of the rise of romantic nationalism, la patrie, the Vaterland, for the Jew. In Prague, he had noticed for the first time that the Jewish community was caught between other communities when nationalism arose. In Prague, there were the Czechs and there were the Sudeten Germans. And as nationalism burgeoned among them, the Jews were caught between. In Prague, there were two universities, a Czech university and the German university, and there was no cooperation between the faculties. Particularly the social science faculties were in a sense the centers of nationalist propaganda for the one or for the other polity. Einstein was appalled by this. He saw the consequences of this for the Jew, for his fellow Jewish intellectuals. He saw the quotas, the limitations, and he began to think about Jewishness as a base, as a root, which was international, which was pacific, which was devoted to social justice, but had no patience with the arbitrary divisions of wealth, which could provide people with a balance, a sense of history, a sense of place, which they could not find in Europe. At the end of the First World War, Einstein, by this time the leading Jewish scientist of Europe, was besieged by any number of Jewish intellectuals and academics from Poland, from Hungary, from Bulgaria, from Russia, who had been displaced by the war, and who sought through him letters of introduction to one faculty or another towards gaining some position commensurate with their skills. And wherever he turned, whatever letters he wrote, whatever the qualification of the individuals, he found that in Germany, they wanted only German scholars. In Belgium, they wanted only Belgian scholars. In Italy, they wanted only Italian scholars. These people were being treated as Jews and dismissed or not granted and not even an interview because of the fact of their Jewishness. This experience at the end of the First World War, combined with the fact that during the war, his activities on behalf of peace had led him to be damned by the more romantic German nationalists as a traitor, the Jew traitor, and his physics to be demanded, to be demeaned as Talmudic physics, false, subversive, led Einstein to realize that for the Jew to be able to live as a human being, he would have to have a place of his own, and hence his wholehearted, lifelong commitment, conversion, if you will, to Zionism, involvement with the Jewish people, with the cause of the creation of a Jewish cultural homeland. Einstein was to spend the rest of the years of his life both as scientist, as world citizen, and as Jew. He would, with the rise of Hitler, not go back to Germany. He tried as best he could during those terrible days to succor as many fellow scholars and their families from Germany and Central Europe as he could and to find them place in the American universities. I'm sure that there's not a major university in the United States or England which does not have a full dossier of letters written on behalf of dozens of candidates by Einstein seeking support for this Jew or that Jew of capacity had to flee from Nazis. The events of the 20s and 30s, 40s, presented a great deal of work for Einstein, the Jew. And as a scientist, he recognized that he had a world position, which allowed him to speak out on issues and to be heard, and he used that pulpit to speak out against the rise of all that Hitler and National Socialism stood for in Europe. As a Jew, standing within the Jewish community, as a mind interested in all that affected the mind, Einstein became not only a Zionist, but a well-read Jew. He became acquainted with a number of the leading Jewish figures and Jewish scholars of the day. He came to know the Gaonic literature, at least as it was explained to him, the mystical literature and the philosophic literature. He became a Jew of some learning. But he never became a synagogue Jew. Einstein was not one who believed that there was a personal God to whom one could pray and who might respond in his wisdom to individual human needs. Einstein believed in Spinoza's God. He believed that there was a design to the universe. He believed that the greatest mystical moment that a man could have was in trying to understand the will of God as it was revealed in that universe. He responded to what Spinoza called the amor Deus intellectualis, the intellectual love of God. That is, the ability to sense God in the majesty and the size and symmetry and the motion and the creative design which is represented by the cosmos, by nature. He was not above the same kind of feeling that because he was world-renowned in physics, he could pontificate at will about almost any other subject on the face of the earth. That's a very normal human failing. And in his latter years, he loved to discuss his religious views. He coined a phrase, cosmic religion. Cosmic religion to Einstein was no more or less than the awe which he felt before the design which is of God's. And he believed that he served that God by defining the mechanisms, the equations which described how the universe was put together, how it operated. I believe he wrote someplace in Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the orderly harmony of all that exists. I do not believe in a God who concerns himself with the fates, actions of human beings. He used to describe his work as motivated by a desire to know God's thoughts. Now this man to whom the universe was a grand design decipherable ultimately to man, was obviously a person motivated by the highest humane and concerns with justice and human compassion. He was involved with all the good causes of his time, all the causes that made for the redemption of the poor, the elimination of war, the elimination of poverty and malnutrition and of ignorance around the world. But he did not look upon these as simply as Jewish values. These were simple, broad human values. They conformed to what was necessary for man to live successfully within this grand design, which is that of the universe. What he did not believe in was an impersonal immortality, and he got answering prayer. He developed a certain love of ritual. He felt ritual was educative. It had a value of bringing people together, but it had no purpose, you know, in and of itself. One ritual essentially was as good as any other. His faith in this God who created this grand universe was an optimistic one. He used to say, God is subtle, but he is not malicious. The universe is a beautiful thing. Therefore, the possibilities for human life within this universe are full of promise that man will only cease to be the kind of craven, cruel, calculating, callous beast that he sometimes allows himself to be. There was a kind of messianic, optimistic element to Spinoza's and to Einstein's faith, which we recognize as Jewish. But there's an interesting paradox in all of this. Though he had no belief, precisely because he had no belief in a personal God, precisely because he had this great belief in the divine, in the great grand design of the universe, he spent his last years trying to uncover a unified field theory, equations which would describe all of the universe, all of the activities of the universe in a single set of mathematical equations, which would give men ultimately the capacity to describe the way in which all things work and all things relate one to the other. Electricity to matter to light to energy and on and on. And the interesting thing is that during the latter years of Einstein's life, science was moving beyond the universe of Spinoza, the universe where all is can be described, there is a cause for every effect. Scientists were discovering more and more that there is a kind of randomness to the universe, that there are actions within the sub-electrical particles of the atom which cannot be described as the result of any particular cause. There's a principle of indeterminacy in the world. There is a mystery beyond the mystery that Einstein himself sought to describe or recognized. And that there is, given the nature of our universe, place for those very scandalous ideas about the personality of God, about God responding in some miraculous or mysterious way to man, to all creatures that the traditional religions have espoused, which Einstein himself could not respond to. Science tended to pass Einstein by in the last 20 years or so of the universe, of his life. He could not accept the consequences of the new discoveries. There was not simply an electromagnetic field, but many fields. That there was a principle of randomness in the activities of energy, which could not be described as, in a very specific way, as a result of a specific cause. So that the theology of Einstein remains, I suspect, as the theology of any man. Very personal, very private, wise to him, foolish to others who do not share his particular view or his particular faith. But I find it difficult to sympathize with those clerics who in the last years of Einstein's life, as he began to talk more and more about cosmic religion and his ideas, began to brand him as an atheist, and therefore with the assumption that somehow an atheist is less of a human being, less humane, less compassionate, less wise than we who have faith. Fulton Sheehan, that smooth-voiced preacher of the Roman Catholic Church, was the man who particularly went after Einstein in the latter years of his life, accusing him of all manner of weakness, failure because of his religious views. I must say that I give credit to my colleagues at the time that they never once, in any significant way, attacked Einstein on his theology. We Jews have been, you know, remarkably tolerant over the centuries of our peculiar ideas about ultimate questions. We've had the good sense to know that no one really knows, not even Einstein. And so, whatever the mishigas, whatever the theology that any one of us has about God, that's not the test. The test is, what kind of a mensch are you? What kind of a human being are you? Are you compassionate, empathetic, sensitive, committed to justice, alert, able to assimilate the facts of your time? Do you have a vision about the future of mankind? If you do, God is with you and you are with God, and God bless you. So our people blessed Einstein, blessed him for his Zionism, blessed him for his support of the Hebrew University, delighted that he was able, given the privilege, to deliver the inaugural lecture at the Hebrew University in 1925, delighted that he was offered the presidency of the State of Israel for the death of Chaim Weizmann. We remember him warmly as one of our own. We remind ourselves, even as we do, that to be one of our own is to be also concerned citizens.